good morning, good afternoon, good evening to you, depending on your location today. This is Ali Amagasu. And as you know, you've tuned into another episode of Cloud Unfiltered. We thank you very much for that. With me today is, as always, my co-host, Pete Johnson, coming to you from the Nerd Lair in upstate Michigan. Hey, Pete.
Hey, Ali, how are you doing? I think it's the time of the year where I'm starting to surpass you in weather quality because it's 67 degrees outside today and just gorgeous outside.
Yeah, I don't know that you can see how things are here, but we are having the weirdest, grayest, ickiest spring ever in Southern California, and it's wrong. I read yesterday that it's like 84 degrees in the Arctic Circle or something, and I was, this is just wrong on so many levels.
Your air quality is going to start to suffer here pretty soon, too.
Yeah, not enjoying it. I hear that the Chihuahua situation is escalating over there. Don't worry.
Yeah, it sounds like it is. I think when you introduce Scott, I'm going to go up, hop upstairs real quick and take care of that.
Is there a mailman or what is going on?
Well, it could be UPS, and my wife has a doctor's appointment. When we usually record these things, she's usually in charge of Chihuahua wrangling, but you know, left to their own devices, this is what can happen.
It's okay. I think they're charming. Anyway, let me introduce our guest. His name is Scott Ford. He is a distinguished architect with Chef, and we are so happy to have you with us today. Welcome, Scott.
Ali, thank you very much. Happy to be here.
I have to say, we haven't talked to anybody from any of the big automation companies in a while. So I'm excited. I have questions. And my first one out of the gate is going to kind of seem like just a bucket of cold water because I'm not even getting into, I'm assuming that people know what Chef does. Maybe I shouldn't. I'm going to step back a second and say, for people who don't know what Chef does, take a minute. Tell us kind of what you guys do, what your main offerings are, so they can understand where this discussion is going to go.
Well, no, that's great. It's a great place to start, actually, because this is a challenge that Chef faced even with our own customers, because we Chef is an automation company, automation around infrastructure and applications and also compliance. But really, when we think about today, our customers are large enterprises to small businesses as well that are deploying their applications on-prem and in the cloud, and they need to do that all from the way that we've learned from the leaders out there is that change should be driven from code and it should be automated. And that's where Chef, that's what Chef is, our specialty is.
I feel like you guys have been around for a while. How long has Chef been in business?
Yeah, so Chef as a company has been in business for 10 years now. The original configuration management tool, Chef, came out 10 years ago.
Interesting. So you've seen some changes over that time. And what I wonder is, what's different? What are enterprises able to automate now that they couldn't 5 years ago or 10 years ago? What's the new hotness in the automation space? It may not just apply to you guys. It may apply to, you know, across the board, across to many companies.
That's a great question. Well, I'd say for us, a really big differentiator and something that's gotten a lot of our customers really excited is this idea of automating compliance controls. So Chef's DNA is very much in the approach, like we've always embraced the idea that automation, writing automation code is software development. There's really no different than any other code you're writing inside your organization. If you're writing Java code and building artifacts, Chef code starts on a developer's laptop and flows out from the left to the right through source control and CI pipelines and so on until you produce artifacts and deploy them out. Now, part of this, what we've seen in the enterprise space is one of the biggest blockers to the transformation to speed is this idea around security and compliance. Security and compliance for a lot of our customers exists in a state that it is a gate that teams must pass through in order to get their applications deployed out. But we've been doing software, we've been doing test-driven development for years. That's existed for years. And so a while back, Chef was down this road of, you know, helping our customers not just write Chef automation code, but set up pipelines and deploy their changes through CI pipelines. And we started looking at that challenge of like, well, what if we could take the controls, you know, the regulatory guidelines that these changes have to pass through and codify those and put them in a way that when if I'm a developer and I'm writing automation code, I can test that code for compliance standards while I'm on my laptop. And when I check my changes into source control and that change merges and goes through a pipeline, we test again. And then once my changes are actually deployed, my infrastructure is running, my apps are running, then I'm continually testing my my environments to make sure that they adhere to the compliance standards and so on. So I'd say that that one right there has just, that's been a game changer for Chef. We, about 3 years ago, purchased we acquired a German security company that come up with a testing framework called InSpec, which is the ability to take types of controls. So if we think about like particular packages that either need to be on a system or should be removed from a system, or services that should or should not be running, et cetera, you can write the tests and have those run, and the output of that is a true or false. So this is actually making no changes to a system, but purely validating that a system or an application is in the state that it's supposed to be in. And so I look at that right now, and it's one of our most exciting areas out there, that and something that enterprises didn't used to be able to do, but can do today.
Are they even aware that's possible right now? Are most customers even aware?
That's a great question as well. For a lot of them, yes, it is absolutely picking up steam, and we've got a lot of InSpec itself is of course an open source framework, and we've got contributions from Chef customers, but also outside of the Chef community, individual engineers, government agencies that are also contributing back to the framework itself. So we've seen a lot of momentum.
Interesting. Well, in general, I wonder if you obviously have a fuller picture than probably your customers do of what can be automated and what should be automated. And what I wonder is, when they come to you, do you feel like most enterprises know where the real value is going to be and they ask you to automate the right things, or are they usually interested in kind of the wrong things? It sounds exciting, but it's not going to deliver as much value as what they think.
Enterprises by themselves, God, we could spend this whole time talking about this specifically, but you know, we live in a world where I feel that a lot of IT and in enterprise, there's still a lot of centralized IT that owns specific function. And there's this foundation that came, years before, of buying solutions that you install and set up and deploy, and you start to get value out of it. But automation is something that somebody has to write, So in the beginning, there is this place, enterprises have to grapple with this idea that there is this whole digital transformation that people like to talk and throw around, but it's for real. I mean, you can't just deploy DevOps in an environment and hope and it just works. It's not like that. There is this transformation about all the other things that go along with it. And what I was touching on before, the software development best practices, right? You have to embrace it all. That includes understanding how the value of storing your source code inside of, tools like Git and Bitbucket, GitLab, et cetera, using CI/CD pipelines. So getting the value out of it involves a lot of different things. The technology is always the easy part. It's the cultural parts, the aspects that are the biggest challenges in transforming the enterprise.
As a marketer, I appreciate you validating that digital transformation is a real thing and not just something that we're flinging around trying to sell stuff. Pete, I have to imagine that this provoked a question or two from you.
Yeah, so you talked about sort of that it's not just about deploying DevOps, but you have to do some stuff with it. Are you seeing, are enterprises seeing the ROI on DevOps, or are different parts of an enterprise either seeing it or not seeing it? Like the line of business teams doing heads down software development for whatever ecosystem they're trying to get customers in, versus the IT team that tends to be a little bit more legacy driven and maybe a little more cost conscious. Are you seeing differences in enterprises as a whole, or in differences in groups within enterprises?
Yeah, I would say it really depends on the group that you're talking with, and it really does. In the places where I've seen success, it really does involve a whole from top down, everybody on board. So I don't know who in the audience out there has read the Phoenix Project, but that's for real. Like finding a leader with the vision to and the courage to be really bold about thinking about the way to solve that challenge, you can have absolute success. I can't cite specific customers by name on this, but I've had the privilege in the last 5 years and even in the last year and a half to work with some incredible leaders that have been backs against the wall, IT projects that have deadlines that they realize are not going to deliver, not the long term. They might deliver a short term goal of getting some IT automation project out there, but the longer term, how do we actually build something that's sustainable? It really does take a Phoenix project scenario to go in there and let's do something from end to end. Let's take an application and let's automate the whole thing from left to right. When I say left to right, I'm always talking about change starts on the developer's laptop. Somebody's going to write code somewhere. So open up your laptops, write some code, let's get that in source control, and let's start collaborating in that way. The enterprises that I've seen have the most success are the ones that they have this foundation where they believe that everything should be driven as code, right? Everything should be driven as code versus the teams that are not having success where they are the human handoffs between team to team, that kind of central IT design where you have the VMware team that spins up VMs. Could you imagine like if AWS launched EC2 and they're like, guess what? You can have VMs as fast as you want them. You're like, great, I got my VM. And they're like, well, how do I log into this? Well, you got to open up a ticket and there will be an IP address assigned to you. And that should be done in like a week. That's for real. I mean, that's the type of stuff that we see in there where it's not code driven. It's not an API that I can launch and get an environment spun up, but it is actually these types of handoffs, manual handoffs between teams. And those are the areas where we really see the possibilities of automation start to fall short.
What was the name of the book? Sorry.
The Phoenix Project. No, it's okay.
Has everybody read that? Was that something we should think that everybody's read? I haven't read it.
It's like a novelization of what an IT team might go through when they're going through some kind of digital transformation kind of thing. And yeah, I forget what year it came out, but it's pretty transformative and it's compelling because it tells it in a novel form, as opposed to, you know, a data sheet or something like that. But yeah, Scott's right. It's those are the kinds of leaders that you need. And what I was going to ask as a follow-up is, do you see people sort of seeing the scarcity? Because I've been in this business, I've been in tech for long enough that the scarce resource used to be the physical machine. And that's why you protect it with a ticketing system, is because it used to be if you screwed up a physical machine, it took you several months to get a new one. So that's why all these processes exist, to protect against change control on those physical machines. But as the unit of compute got, you know, when it went from months to minutes to seconds to in some cases milliseconds, that no longer becomes the scarce resource. Now human time has become the scarce resource. And much to your point, the more that you can automate, the less human time you can take out of a system. Like what percentage, when you even get involved in a project at a customer, like, do they already get that? Or is there some convincing that still has to be done?
Oh, there's still often a lot of convincing that needs to be done. Absolutely. And, you know, for better or for worse, in Chef, we talk often about this idea of shifting left, right? Shifting left is the idea that, again, if change is starting on the laptop, let's try to do as much of the testing and automation that we can do starting on the laptop as possible. So Pete, to your point about VMs, right? If I have to request a VM from ops and they're gonna launch it out for me in a week that I can log into, I may make changes to that VM. The next time I go to run my tests against it, if there are changes that existed from my previous tests in there, I'm not starting from a clean state. All of a sudden you're starting to introduce risk further out and to the right as we get systems that are not like production and not repeatable. One of the areas that we start off with in the world of Chef with any of our customers is this idea around local development. The ability to provision a VM using tools like Vagrant or, of course, EC2 or Azure, spinning up VMs quickly that you can spin up, run your automation code on, be working on automation code, iterate, tear it down, and then the next morning, spin it right back up, and you're in the exact same state. There's another piece, of course, that goes along with this that we do a lot of work on, which is creating base images from code and so on. But, you know, anything that we can do to shift left, get people to value, get people to a repeatable process, more efficient process, we're going to drive down risks. We're going to drive down costs. We're going to make people more efficient, ultimately go faster.
Right.
So I'm at risk here of exposing my true lack of technical knowledge here, but I'm going to ask the question anyway. I'm wondering where automation and AI intersect, if they ever do, because as somebody who'd be an end user, to me, I don't know that something that's automated would look that much different to me from something where a smart machine has figured out my habits. When Ali launches a cluster, I automatically, you know, if it's been automated, these are her security settings. It's going to connect her to this network. If this is her storage, da 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 da. Now, whether a machine that's happened from machine learning software or from automation software that someone's actually entered those parameters probably makes no difference to me. So does it become part of your solution, or is it two separate things that should stay separate?
Well, Chef, as far as using AI in our own products, that's not something that we're focused on right now. Chef is more about the glue. When you talk about Ali launching out a cluster, the glue that brings that all up and the way that systems communicate and find each other and talk, that's really where automation starts to cross into something like AI.
Yeah.
So, sorry. Yes.
No, go right ahead. I'm interested in understanding that difference. Do you guys view it as a threat then? If you guys aren't doing, is somebody doing it? Is it going to change the way automation works, do you think?
Well, look, there's lots of different patterns that exist out there that companies are using to deploy applications. Of course, there's traditional work. I mean, companies are still deploying, you know, stateful services on bare metal. There's VM. There is still, you know, there's new patterns like Pivotal Cloud Foundry and Mesosphere, and of course Kubernetes. There's serverless, right? There's lots of different patterns that exist out there. But for the majority of those patterns, there is still infrastructure, you know, there that you have to deploy out. There is still security that you need to put in place for system. There is typically artifacts that we build. If we're building containers, those still start again from that left to right flow of writing Docker files that create our containers, then build them out. And you have to think about when my application deploys, how is it going to find other services? How is it going to find things like secrets management to be able to pull in and authenticate and find other services and so on. So your AI systems that you deploy, that whole process needs to be thought of about how you're going to automate the glue, if you will, that it binds it all together. And Chef has a number of different areas, you know, Chef, the configuration management tool. If you're bringing up, say, your own Kubernetes clusters on-prem, some people still do it versus using the cloud offerings. You still have systems. They still need to be configured. They need to be hardened and tuned and patched, et cetera, so that they're deployed to your standards and then deploy the services out on top. Chef also has an application automation framework, which is not as widely known throughout our community and throughout the space out there, which is called Habitat. And it deals with the higher level abstractions around really solutions that we need around application automation itself. So how do we build our application into artifacts? Where do we want to deploy those artifacts to? Once they're deployed, how do we deal with the application lifecycle management of them? So how do we update them? How do we configure them? How do we health check, smoke check, service discovery, topologies, all that? So Habitat's a big topic, which I'm happy to go into detail around, but so if you're looking for automation itself and where AI fits in there, I think that right now today, it's more about deploying the systems and clusters that would support AI rather than AI to be used to how we better automation itself. But that would be an exciting area to go into, absolutely. So
that's a great answer. You know, you mentioned on-prem Kubernetes deployment. And it made me wonder how much are you seeing as far as private clouds? I know there's a number of of companies coming out with, it seems like, on-premises solutions lately to complement, say, an existing public cloud presence. You know, for whatever reason, there's data that they need to keep on site. There's software they need to keep on site. Are you guys seeing a lot of that?
So, believe it or not, in the Fortune, like, you know, the global 5,000 companies and a lot kind of larger mid-sized enterprises, it's 100%. All of them still have their own private clouds. I can tell you that some of the biggest names that you and I know here in up and down California and Southern California that have told us in my first year that I was here at Chef, I was on site. Everything's going to AWS. 100%. Everything's going there. You know what? They're still deployed on-prem. And this is because IT projects are not easy. They're really, I can see that anything net new could get deployed out into AWS. But as far as like, are we ready to just shut down the data centers? No, we're not. So it's still across our customers. It's the ones that I'm dealing with, our largest enterprise customers, it's 100% of them still maintain their own data centers. And in some cases, they're deploying, they're standing up newer data centers right now, more modern data centers as well. So I still, it's going, from my viewpoint, it's going to be hybrid for a very long time.
There you go, listeners. Don't feel guilty if you still have stuff in your own data center. You're not the only one, not even close.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, of course, they, as I said before, they've all got the newer initiatives out there for microservices and serverless and so on. But there are certain workloads that exist that either they're not going to ever port to one of those platforms, or they need to keep them on-prem for some specific reason. So, yeah, there's some really, really neat stuff. I mean, so much to go into around that, you know, concerns around security of, you know, certain enterprise customers feeling whether or not they can trust going into the public cloud. But then also the other things that are preventing them too are like right now there's this burning issue out there for a lot of our enterprise, which is the end of Windows 2008 support. And if you come in there and you tell them, hey, everything, just let's put it all in Kubernetes. I mean, honestly, that's not a solution. You can't just say everything's going into Kubernetes. There are workloads in there that will never, ever run in Kubernetes. So how do we deal with those as well? How do we get ourselves automated and off of older platforms like that? So
I did not know that was a burning issue. Pete, did you know that the end of Windows 2008 support was?
It doesn't surprise me that it is. And I would imagine that that's like a tell question that you might ask a customer at the beginning. I mean, you mentioned running on-prem, running services on bare metal hardware too. I know, like for an example, it's been a while since I've had to do an in-customer pre-sales presentation. But if you walk into the room and they hand you a VGA cable to connect to the projector as opposed to an HDMI cable or a Cisco proximity device, that tells you about sort of where a company might be generally in their technology adoption. So I take it from that laugh, Scott, that you agree with that sometimes there's tell questions like that you can tell within 5 minutes about what the conversation is going to be like, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, I encounter it. It's all too common for me. Absolutely.
Well, and I once worked in an IT organization that was freaking out over VB5 going out of support. And like, yeah, I mean, if it's an application that you haven't touched for 10 years and everybody who wrote it, you know, has retired, it can be a scary thing because you're looking at an expensive, well, at least of what you perceive to be an expensive rewrite in order to get it to run somewhere else. So when someone has that concern, so is that an opportunity for them to say, look, if you have to rewrite this because this is going out of support anyway, here's how you can rewrite it in a way that gives more power to the left side of this diagram. So are those conversations that get sparked by those kind of things for Chef employees?
Yeah, so absolutely. We're really, really excited right now. So we've, with Habitat specifically. So Habitat is application automation again. It's you write what are called plan files that describe how to build an artifact. And Habitat supports both Windows and Linux. So on Windows side of things, you're writing PowerShell scripts that describe the common steps you would need. I mean, are we building a COTS application? Do I need to go and download an artifact from somewhere and unpack it and put things in certain place, configuration files? In a habitat plan, we have what are called life cycle hooks that describe things like what would the script look like that would run an application or reconfigure an application or health check or smoke check an application. And each one of those scripts is also bundled up in this artifact that we write. Just like automation that we were talking before, that like it, somebody's got to start and write this from scratch. What we looked at around the Windows 2008 issue that's going on out there was, is there a way that we could actually inspect these systems somehow and build habitat plans automatically for our customers? Right. And what we were able to determine is the answer is yes. So with Chef's compliance testing framework, InSpec, we were able to write profiles that describe questions about our applications deployed onto Windows 2008 servers. So we're talking specifically like ASP.NET, IIS applications, and be able to run our InSpec compliance tool against a server and automatically build a habitat plan as well as the configuration details, you know, so Habitat can bind to other services and so on. So it will automatically populate binds to databases, et cetera, and give you a point that what you end up with is a Git repo that has a habitat plan that you can take back to your local laptop, or you can drop into Azure DevOps and you can just run a build. And it will produce you an immutable artifact that is your application, all of its dependencies. So when I say all of its dependencies, all of its configuration, all of the system DLLs that are needed to deploy that particular application are all bundled up. And with this versus like a lift and shift where you go in and you take and you recreate it somewhere else, we actually, what our customers are left with is a complete CI/CD pipeline for building and deploying their application. And with this immutable artifact, I can go and run that on a VM. I can go and run that in the cloud. I can run it on-prem. But habitat artifacts that you build can also be exported into other formats, including Docker containers. You can build, you can export to Helm charts, Pivotal Cloud Foundry, Mesosphere, and more. So you have one pipeline that can take your artifact and then run it in different places that you need to be able to run it. So
once you get that initial bundle and you can get it into that habitat format, then you've got some choice that you've got going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And we proved this out with some of the just nastiest applications too. You know, when you come out with new technology like Habitat, I mean, obviously one of the first questions any enterprise is going to say is like, prove it. And so we've had customers come back to us and we said, listen, give us something hard, give us something of importance to your company. It can't just be like, yeah, of course you did it with that one. And it's like, I want something that means something to the business, and let's show that we can port it. And we've had customers come back to us. You know, one example was an old application that was running on Windows 2003. It was an old Com Plus application. They had it was a COTS application, so consumer off the shelf, and this application was handling financial transactions with the Central Bank of Brazil. So literally this large enterprise, any of the dealings that they had, the work they were doing was going through this particular application. It was taking them like, you know, 2 to 3 weeks to deploy out new versions anytime they got updates from the vendor. And what we were able to do with the barrier to entry for Habitat applications is 32-bit or higher, and it needs to support a silent install. So in that's par for the course for really any automation. You can't automate something that if you have to click through a GUI and click yes, yes, next, next, right? So we did a little bit of back and forth with the vendor. But when we came back to this particular customer, we were able to show their application building in under 30 seconds, deploying out instantly wherever they were running it. And we showed it running on the latest Windows 2016 VM, but also running in a Windows 2000, a Windows container as well. So it's extremely portable, and you know, the results that we're getting with building applications that people thought were really unautomatable we're able to do. So it's really exciting stuff.
Com objects for the win. I didn't think we'd go into this conversation and mention com objects For you kids out there, that predates .NET, and I had to look that up. .NET's first release was in 2002, so COMObjects was the Microsoft technology that predated that. So imagine having to take an application that's got an 18-year-old technology and getting it to run in a container. That's awesome sauce.
It is indeed. And I'm still fixated on these enterprises that are dealing with the end of Windows 2008. What happens? Like, what's their deadline? How long do they have to figure this out?
Well, so it's really a cost question, right? Because you can, of course, go and pay Microsoft for extended support. And so it's cost, and how much do they really want to go in there and do that? Microsoft, of course, would love to see these workloads in running in Azure instead of, and so, you know, there's lots of companies out there with skin in the game trying to help solve this. We've got a kind of unique approach how we want to go about it, which is not just a lift and shift, but an application modernization and transformation. So we can get you from going to, I have no idea how it's built, to, yeah, there's the actual plan, how it's built. It's running through a pipeline and it's delivered the same way that we deliver, you know, the same shape that we would deliver an application or build a container as well.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Hey, we're running up against the end of our time limit here, but I wanna make sure we cover everything. Are there any questions I haven't asked you yet that I should ask you about what's going on interesting in the automation space? And also, Pete, if there's anything left that you wanted to ask.
I'm good. I was, like I said, I'm thrilled that that COMObjects came up, that we rarely have a guest that knows what that is. So I'm feeling less of an old man right now. So thank you for that, Scott.
Well, Pete, I'm thrilled that you didn't go and ask any follow-up questions about COMObjects, because I am actually a Linux systems administrator. That's the root for me. But over these last few years, you know, Chef has always tried to treat Windows as a first-class citizen. So the work that we're doing just in Chef, the configuration management in spec, and now Habitat as well, has forced my hand to learn about all kinds of things. I thought, keep me away from that stuff.
I know, right? Well, if you need help, I was Windows NT4 certified in 1998. So you've got a back door should you need it.
I just like to say, it has been amazing to watch Microsoft over these last few years and the transformation that's going on out there with under Satya Nadella. It's just exciting. They're like, you know, Windows 10 is going to ship with that. You can run Linux natively inside of Windows soon. And you know, for some of my colleagues that are now writing Habitat plans, they write the Windows laptop is the ultimate development workstation, because you can build Habitat plans for Linux and you can build them from Windows, where if you're running a MacBook or you're running Linux, you can only build for the Linux environment. So there's just all kinds of exciting stuff that's going out there. It's been amazing for me to sit by and watch my customers have so much more success with automating Windows and that whole ecosystem that they never were able to before.
Cool stuff.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Scott, and sharing, you know, your insights into what's going on in the world of automation and what enterprises are struggling with. We appreciate it. And I think it's always very, very helpful to our listeners. So we appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Oh, I can't thank you enough for inviting me. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Great. Have a great afternoon.
Thanks. You as well. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye-bye, Pete.
Bye.